It has been a little while since we've talked with Dr. Catherine McCarty. She's an epidemiologist and the Associate Dean for Research and a professor in the Department of the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth campus. And in the middle of school beginning, online and everything else, there's a lot of interesting COVID-19 news in the news. And of course, we took advantage of the opportunity to get her on the phone and get a reaction and to have her unpack a few of these things for us. Hey, Catherine, good morning and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's great to be with you again.
So the new Trump pandemic advisor, who apparently doesn't really have a background in medicine or pandemics, has suggested, he's back to suggesting the herd immunity strategy. Is that something that we need to be concerned about, or is it, I guess I've sort of seen the pushback from science increasing in some ways and decreasing in others. As somebody who really does understand what's going on here, what's your sense of it?
So herd immunity is a bad idea, and there's a pretty good agreement in the scientific community for that. And the reason for that, let me tell you what herd immunity is first. Basically, and we've seen a country, Sweden, tried to do this, that thought it was successful and then not. But what happens is we just let everybody roam around, expose each other, and then the theory is with herd immunity that some people will then develop disease, they'll develop immunity to it, and there'll be enough people with immunity, then it's effectively like a vaccine. However, people with the younger, healthier people are the ones with healthy immune systems are the ones likely to survive this strategy. And the people who are not going to survive this strategy are people with other conditions, the elderly, the very young, probably. Bad idea. So we talked previously about how COVID is affecting more our communities of color who are already disadvantaged, and this herd immunity strategy, it is actually, I'm going to call it a racist strategy because that's exactly what it would do. It would hurt people of color. They're very, very bad idea.
It is also, we are also seeing, certainly not in the same numbers, but we are also seeing about the time that we feel like we're ready to say that only people with compromised immune systems die, young people dying. And we are, I want to say that somewhere along the line, there's some, of course, so much information coming out, but I thought I had understood that the people who are getting sick now, the most people getting sick, are kind of in that 30 and 40 degree range. So it's certainly younger than we thought.
It is. And it's our teachers as well. I think that's why a lot of teachers are really uncomfortable going back to schools at the moment. And a number of schools are holding off and going entirely virtually and these hybrid options as well. But you're absolutely right. That demographic of our teachers going back are getting hit hard. I want to mention one other thing while we're at it. We've talked about masks so much. Masks should not be political. We have even more recent in the past week good scientific proof about masks working and showing it in a healthcare settings as well. So early on in the pandemic, we didn't have enough PPE or personal protective equipment. And a study showed that in hospitals where there weren't enough, those not wearing, having the access as good an access were far more likely to not only be exposed, they're in a healthcare setting, but to become infected, become ill and infected. So masks work. They need to fit properly. And I know you've had some discussions about that in the past, but when you put your mask on, breathe in and out really loud. Go, and that mask should be holding onto your face. I know I just bought a new one. I wanted to support a company, a black-run business. And it didn't fit properly, so I put a couple of stitches on the side just so it would fit better on my face. Masks work; they are our answer now. Not herd immunity. We need to be doing our social distancing and we need to be wearing our masks. The other thing that we've learned recently is we need to keep still doing this, is wiping down surfaces. But this is a respiratory disease, which means it's spread through droplets in the air. We can get it from surfaces, but it seems the virus doesn't live very long. Still need to do our wiping down surfaces. But really, the way that we're going to get this under control is to wear masks, distancing and masks, avoiding large groups indoors, which is going to be a challenge, as you've just talked about our weather coming up, where kids are going back to school. We're definitely feeling autumn weather, so that there's going to be this push to be indoors more.
Well, here at KUMD, we were extremely, I thought, clever and proactive. We all have individual little microphone, these little foam microphone shields. Everybody's got their own. So in a business where you have to talk in, you know, of course, shedding droplets right into a piece of equipment, everybody's got their own mic shield. So that's one of the ways that we're trying to make good radio and keep one another safe here at 103.3 KUMD. Something new that is coming up that people are kind of excited about, and I did hear something earlier this week that there is hope that this is also going to be helpful when we begin to get into flu season, which is going to add a whole new dimension to the whole COVID thing, and that is this new COVID-19 saliva testing facility that's opening up down in the cities. How does that work? And talk about the importance of that.
This is very exciting. So your listeners have probably heard about the test that's done currently, and I've not had one done. It apparently can be really very painful.
It's not the most fun I've ever had. Let's just put it that way. Okay.
People describe it as like going into their brain.
it's kind of like a tiny little Roto-Rooter. Yeah.
Yeah. So this new test is going to be far more comfortable. It's just a spit test, effectively. So it's a saliva test, which is great. Some people have not been putting off not wanting to be tested for a whole bunch of reasons, but one because they've heard bad things about this, the existing test. So, yeah, we are bringing online here in the state of Minnesota, we're not the only state, obviously, this new saliva test, which is great. And there'll be collection points all around the state. It does have to go to a central lab, so they're a huge advantage in terms of having this test be more acceptable to people. It'll be less expensive, probably, than the existing test. A slight disadvantage is that it has to go to a central lab. Right now, a lot of those tests, as they're existing, you can go here in town to the local healthcare organizations. They do they have the testing in-house. This will need to go to a central lab, so you need to build in that extra time for getting a sample to a central lab. So we'll need to work out the logistics, especially in rural Minnesota, for that to happen.
Now, as I said, I thought that I also understood that this would also be a way of testing people, or it may show flu, for example. If somebody comes in and they're feeling really sick and it's like, no, you don't have COVID-19, you've got the flu, and that may also be helpful moving forward?
Yes. So this is really cool. Yes, absolutely. They're going to be developing these dual tests that will look for both. And hopefully we'll have if people are practicing these same prevention measures for COVID, we'll have a lighter flu season this year. They're certainly seeing that in Australia currently.
Well, and obviously to try to make sure that people go ahead and get their flu shots, I thought that I also had understood somewhere along the line that flu shots were almost non-negotiable this year, that they were really, really important. Is that the case?
Absolutely. Get your flu shot. The dual infection of having COVID and flu would be really bad, so get your flu shot.
I wondered about that, because they are similar in so many ways. if the one kind of wouldn't work with the other one to just make you really, 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 really sick. The University of Minnesota, of course, has all kinds of interesting research continuing to go on. There's a new treatment that they're looking at. It's a catchy description. They test neutralizing monoclonal antibodies. Yeah, that was clear as mud to me. And there's also, they're finding an association between COVID-19 hospital use and mortality. Now, if I read this correctly, it's if you're sick enough to go into the hospital, you might die. Am I interpreting that the correct way?
You are, and we've seen that from early on. So if you are sick enough to need a ventilator to help you breathe, to be in an ICU, number one, you're probably going to be there for a very long time. So when we've talked about flattening the curve, it's to have enough beds and enough ventilators if people need them. And if you need one, it's improving your likelihood of surviving this, but they're much lower than going into the hospital with a flu. So when people have said it's a bad flu, it's no. If you have a bad case of the flu and you end up in an ICU, you're not there for very long. With COVID-19, you're there for a long time, and you may not survive.
And folks who come out of these long-term ICU situations, they're finally released from the hospital, and the news makes much of this, and of course we're happy to see them reunited with their families. But none of these people comes dancing out of the hospital. They don't look particularly robust. They don't look, as if they're ready to just drop and do push-ups. They look like they're still not really in great health.
No, they're months and months of recovery. Well, anybody who's started an exercise program and before they've gotten into it, you realize how quickly you can become out of shape. And imagine really not moving at all because you're lying in an ICU bed. People lose muscle tone, and it takes a long, long time. And just the virus itself, where people haven't been hospitalized, even they're finding long-term exhaustion.
And people are struggling with that now, and they're finding, as many people have already discovered, about the treachery of the unseen illness. If you have something that is obvious that can be perhaps put in a sling or wrapped up in a cast, people are sympathetic. But if you have something going wrong with you that people can't see, for some weird reason, our assumption as a society is that you're faking it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Much easier to be sympathetic when you can see it for people.
I'm not quite sure what that says about us as a society. Why is that our go-to reaction? Is to push back against somebody's illness instead of to say, "Oh, that's too bad. Can I get you a cup of coffee?"
Yeah. You can't see somebody else's pain and tiredness when it's there.
Now, the neutralizing monoclonal antibody treatments, is there a way to describe how that could possibly work in words that you can string together that actually make some sense to the layperson?
that's a good question. A couple new treatments coming out. I'm going to actually come back to that one because I'm going to tell you about another one, really simple, but we think corticosteroids, and they're used for so many things. If people, they're used, my son has mild asthma, and once a year maybe he'll be ill enough to need an oral steroid, and they cost pennies and really inexpensive, and that's been shown now to be look really quite successful for people who are hospitalized.
I know that my mother, of course, this was earlier days of medicine too, but my mother, who also suffers with asthma, would undergo courses of steroids regularly when she was hospitalized due to breathing issues, and that was just a part of her regular therapy at the time. And I know they've tried to move away from steroids and use them sparingly, but apparently there is a little bit of optimism there.
There is, and as I said, inexpensive treatment. We know how to dose it and manage it, and showing to be successful. So, So that's one that's really exciting. It's already out there. It's available on the market. And the new monoclonal antibodies. So antibodies in infection, when we're testing, we've talked about testing for COVID. And so we have testing of whether or not somebody actively has the disease. And then we've talked about testing for how long you retain having immunity to the disease once you've had it. Because that's all still, we don't know entirely. You know, if you have the disease, can you get it again? And yes, that's been shown to clearly that that does happen. So how long do we retain immunity after we've had the disease? And that is related to having antibodies. So antibodies in your body are those little fighters, those little fighter cells that fight off the infection. And so treatment with monoclonal antibodies really effectively is having fighter cells for the disease, for COVID-19, for the infection.
Ooh, now that does obviously sound good, especially if so that you don't have to spend months in the hospital, as we just talked about. What about as you watch, and I'll ask you this briefly and then I'll let you go, what about as you watch colleges and universities around the country opening schools, closing schools again? The university just announced it was last minute, and yet they said, look, we're watching what's happening with other schools. We're trying to make the absolute best decisions we can to keep our students safe. They pushed back the opening of school a little bit. Classes are going to be held online. And now when kids return to campus, there are going to be some strict rules for a while after students return to campus. How does this seem to you? Does this seem like the university they've maintained all along a strict commitment to science and what the science is showing? And it's pretty handy to have all of these world-renowned research and medical facilities as a part of the university also, isn't it?
It is. So we talked about this in the past, too. Everyone's getting a lesson in epidemiology. Epidemiology 101. We knew just necessarily that there would be another increase of cases after we started relaxing some of those guidelines that were there early on in the epidemic, and not all states had them. And that happened, and we're still seeing that. We've got this steady. We just seem to not be able to bring down here in the state of Minnesota, and we've seen some spikes because of the Sturgis rally in South Dakota. Certainly seen them where they don't have any mask mandate there.
And the first casualty of that they can trace to the Sturgis rally, unfortunately, was a man from Minnesota.
Yes, it was, and really a lot of people affected, and that we'll continue to see that for a couple of weeks yet, just because of the timing of it. So we expected, as some of these restrictions were relaxed, that we would see increase in cases. Again, it was about flattening the curve so that we wouldn't have as many and the hospitals wouldn't be overwhelmed, which is what's happening. We expect necessarily when we have people congregating together, and that next big time that happens is schools, that we would see that again. And as we are seeing, kids are getting it, and if they don't get it, they may be bringing it home. There's some discussion right now at the University of Minnesota. There are plans for how to isolate students if they become infected. But some big discussion now about what universities are doing. Probably not a good idea to send them home, but to find a way to isolate, because if you send them back home, then they're bringing it back home to another community, to parents and grandparents and other people. So, yeah, we're seeing exactly what we expected. So the University of Minnesota really is trying to be very cautious and not have that. Also, there are recommendations about how many tests have to be available, and we're still short on supplies. We've got all the labs set up, and we've talked about this new lab for the saliva tests, but just for the basic tests, we're still seeing a shortage of the supplies that are necessary in that supply chain that we talk about.
How much more difficult? How do you get through to people who are just you know, I think everybody goes through a phase in their, everybody's got their own thing where they say, this won't matter. If I don't make a complete stop at this stop sign, I just kind of roll through it because I'm looking in every direction, so there's nobody here, this won't matter. If I do this thing or that thing, this won't matter. If I get together with 50 of my closest friends because we just got back all together at college, this won't matter. How do you combat, in particular, I think young people who do feel invulnerable and do feel, oh, it isn't going to affect me, or there isn't that much here in Minnesota. How do you talk to people in a way that communicates the importance of this?
I think more real world stories. Stories matter for hearing about how it's impacted people. My husband's aunt died of COVID. Knowing somebody who it's impacted, because especially here where we haven't seen that many and people might not be personally impacted, but to hear more of those stories because it is real and we can do something about it. You know, sometimes you can really feel really frustrated because I can't do anything about these big global things that are worrisome and troublesome. We can individually do something about this by wearing a mask and distancing.
Dr. Catherine McCarty, thank you so much for joining us this morning. You have been such a gift to have on our air throughout the spring and throughout the summer. And as we go into the murky months ahead where we're not really sure what lies before us, helping us to unpack what's going on and to evaluate ideas, new treatments to kind of just give us a better handle on the COVID-19 situation and also to help us understand it better here in our community. Thanks again for being our guest this morning.
Great to talk to you.
Dr. Catherine McCarty is an epidemiologist, and she is an associate dean for research, also a professor with the University of Minnesota Medical School, Duluth campus.